Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern, von wo aus auch immer Sie uns zuschauen. Ich begrüße Sie aus Belgrad, aus Serbien zu dieser Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, zuversichtlich, aufgezeichnet am Sonntag, dem 2. November 2025 in bewegter Zeit. Wir haben die Ehre, die Freude zu begrüßen bei uns im Programm einmal mehr den Präsidenten Serbiens, Aleksandar Vučić, einer der ja mittlerweile auch schon dienstältesten Staatsoberhäupter in Europa. Seit 8 Jahren ist er im Amt und in bewegter, schwieriger Zeit, außenpolitisch, innenpolitisch. Wir haben die Chance, ihn zu einigen dieser Themen zu befragen. Und ich werde jetzt auf Englisch wechseln, damit wir dieses Gespräch starten können. So, Mr. President, it's always a great privilege and honor to have you here in our program. How are you in these very intense times, internationally, nationally?
First of all, very pleased to have you here and honored and privileged to have an opportunity to speak to you. And I'm fine, as you can see. And
as I said to you a few minutes ago, and that personal conversation, but that's not a secret, that's why I can use it even in this official part. Internally, very much okay. Externally, it's a bit more difficult, more complicated and a bit different, but hopefully we'll be able to overcome all the difficulties and to keep stability, peace and tranquility of the country and of the region as well.
Every time I meet you, you seem even more stoic than before, always calm. Is that the real Aleksandar Vučić, or is this your personal armor, this calmness, even in very intense times?
That's a part of my, no doubt, defensive mechanism, as you rightly noticed. Actually, during the crisis time, I'm always calmer than during regular times, because you have to be more cautious, more prudent. You have to take care of every single word you pronounce, and that's why I act like this, but just I'm an ordinary guy having emotions like all the others, and from time to time people make mistakes, I do it on a daily basis. That's why I had to apologize so many times to many people. But I'm just, as I said, an ordinary man, flesh and blood, and that's how it goes. But today I have no reasons not to be calm, apart from the situation with oil industry of Serbia and some other external factors that might cause nervousness in the country, and but everything else is more or less pretty much under control.
When we talked before, in our first conversation, we were living in a rather crazy world. The situation in Ukraine seemed extremely dangerous. The tension between the great powers was growing. How do you see the international stage today? Is it still more crazy than like 1 year before, or is the craziness decreasing?
I believe that is very much unpredictable, which is having this type of volatility in worldwide and in the relationship between big powers is a source of crisis anyway. And if someone knows what is the future of Ukrainian conflict, dare to say that I don't believe in that, and I'm not sure what might happen. Of course, Ukrainians are facing a lot of difficulties today in Pokrovsk and Liman and Kupiansk area, which is not creating their situation better than it used to be. On the other hand, Europeans are deploying more troops, arming them arming them up, nobody knows. If you do it now, what you're gonna do in a year or two, or is it just to repel the Russians, or why do you need this kind of preparations? At the same time, nobody knows what Russians are waiting for, whether to take more territories and then to say, okay, now we are ready, or they want to have a final solution deal, or and would never accept truce, or whatever similar to that. But in that case, you see a lot of changes in American administration behavior almost on a weekly basis. And then you cannot predict. But if I can make there and make my predictions, I believe that Russians will do their utmost and their best to relatively swiftly take under their control Pokrovsk, Liman, and the area around Kupiansk, and then to extend and expand their offensive towards Konstantinovka, Slavyansk, and Kramatorsk. And then they'll be in a position to start negotiating everything with Ukrainians.
What would you say is the stumbling block? I mean, people start to expect peace when the American president was welcoming the Russian president in Alaska, and then suddenly a reversal. The air froze, it got cold again. What is the stumbling block? Why is there no peace, negotiated peace between the US and Russia?
What I believe is the real issue. I think that mainly Russians and Americans agreed upon many things. Russians, to my mind and from the sources I was informed from, that Witkoff and Russians made an arrangement on almost everything. Then Trump, as a successful and decision-making leader, invited Putin to Alaska. They had a good meeting, and Trump thought, rightfully, that he was going to be praised by international community for bringing Putin to that negotiating table, to that round table, together with Ukrainians and all the others, in order to resolve the issue. But everything that happened actually was to the contrary of Donald Trump thought. Why? Because so-called liberal medias, left medias, all those politicians from Europe and from all over the world, they couldn't stand the fact that Trump was bringing two sides close to either ceasefire or truce, either peace, whatever. It will be an end of hostilities. Nobody actually wanted to see it, and they started criticizing very, very hard President Trump, which was absolutely unjust, for something that he did in a very best way. That Alaska summit was a ray of hope for an entire world. All of a sudden, 3 days after, 4 days after, everything was ruined. Because of huge action taken against President Trump, he always takes care of people's opinion, of public audience, of everything else. And he was attacked by almost everybody within the United States and out of the United States. And they were using that media power, political power, all the European leaders gathered in Washington, asking him not to go with a lot of confidence towards Putin, and no trust at all, and everything else. That deteriorated Trump's internal position, and also there was something that those liberal medias counted on. They played on Trump's vanity. They were all lying and saying that Putin won that game, that Putin humiliated him. But actually the guy that had to be praised at that time was actually Donald Trump. But they wanted to humiliate him, to say to him that he was defeated by Putin, and then he wanted to show, okay, you did not defeat me, now I'm gonna do something like that. Apart from that, there are real reasons and serious reasons, because Trump expected to reach that peace as soon as possible, and it didn't happen. There are reasons for that. Number one, Putin wanted to take territories that he had already claimed as part of Russia. How he can refer to, how he can cope with his own public audience and saying, okay, when I was saying Donbass area, it was Lugansk plus Donetsk, but this Donetsk is, okay, less than 50% or around 50%. Okay, people did not count on an entire Zaporozhye or Kherson region, but they counted on entire Donbass. Now it's not an easy situation for him to do so. At the same time, Zelensky cannot accept anything, because from the very obvious reasons, how he can say that he denies or he is against or he denounces his own territorial integrity and UN Charter? He cannot do it. He cannot do it. And it's a difficult, very difficult situation. And the only chance that Trump had actually was a compromising solution in which both sides would be not satisfied. But you have one side that is winning militarily, although it's not easy for them at all. They're deteriorating economically, mean Russia. And on the other hand, Ukraine cannot survive without American support. Which means that you have to have both sides equally dissatisfied in order to get them to peace, but still that's not the case. That's why I'm not that optimistic as I was after Alaska.
Hmm. How would you describe the position of the European Union? I got a lot of readers and viewers who write me that they think the EU is actually sabotaging the peace protest. They want to derail the peace process because these politicians in Brussels, they cannot confess that they were wrong in their whole assessment of the situation. Is the EU trying to sabotage?
We discussed that. I'll respond to your very open and question, in-depth question, in a bit different way. Europe is a place where people live the best lives in the world, the best living standard, social welfare systems, everything. And those people are not ready to accept changes that are obvious to everybody, but they cannot accept it. We remember during the Western Roman Empire reign, people were indulging and enjoying their lives, and they didn't want to see what was happening in the Alps, what was happening in Africa, what was happening in Asia, what was happening around them, because the Rome was far away from everything. This showed to us that almost 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago, when everything started, that people did not understand, that some people did not understand, some EU member states did not understand that the world was changing. Like Russians or Serbs did not understand, we did not understand. Okay, I was young, but we did not understand what was changed when Germany was unified. For us, it was 3, 4, or 5,000 bricks of one wall. We didn't understand the political meaning of that. And we paid a huge price for that in former Yugoslavia. Whenever you don't understand what's going on, whenever you are not ready to accept facts and reality, you have to pay the price, which is true. Now Europe is paying the price of being 100% unrealistic and at the same time 100% biased. And now they all see that, okay, militarily Ukraine cannot win the war. Ukrainians were fighting courageously, bravely. Nobody expected that they were able to defend themselves to that extent in such a brave way. But at the end, they cannot win the war. Like Serbs couldn't win against NATO. There had been no chances for that. But we did not understand it from the very first moment. At least we stopped it after 78 days. But the problem today is, one political issue is that some European leaders cannot accept the fact that they made a wrong assessment, a wrong estimation, and a political mistake. Number two, I believe that they should have been talking with Moscow all these 3.5 years in order to stop their attacks, in order to stop that war, but also in order to give an exit to Russia, to say to them, okay, we wait for you, stop this, but we wait for you to be a part of us, to be a part of the international community. Open the doors. You cannot close all the doors and then waiting for a solution. And when they say, okay, our solution is easily accessible, it's just about Russians, they need to stop their aggression. But it doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. It cannot work like that. It's not realistic. Now, I don't see what Europe lost what we called in chess or maybe in football, it's tempo. Now US is deciding on everything together with Russians and Ukrainians, but without European leaders. And who lost that position? We, Europeans, all of us, all together. I mean, we belong to Europe as well, like Switzerland belong to Europe this or another way. Sure. Yes, and we lost that opportunity, and we are not present anymore. We decide all together, all of us, 500 million, we decide on nothing. And it will remain so. It will remain so. Mm-hmm. Okay, now we need to realize that situation is different, and we need to try to get to the point where peace will become more acceptable for Russians and for Ukrainians as well. And it has to be a painful solution for both sides. If they are going to be equally dissatisfied, that would be the real compromising solution. But on the other hand, we as Europeans will not be asked, we won't be a participator of that deal, and that's it. Which also means that we'll have to pay the price in the future regarding raw materials, minerals, rare metals, gas, oil, and everything else, because I think that Russians will insist, that's my guess, that a part of a deal, because they'll have to do some compromising solutions at the end, within 6 months or a year, whatever, that they will ask for a bigger deal, greater deal with Americans on the other issues. Mm-hmm. And once again, all of us will be excluded from that deal.
I think the politicians, as far as I know, in Europe, they still think Russia can be defeated. I see it in the news. They say they have great problems economically. They cannot hold on to this war, and we have to push them to their knees. How realistic is that? Can Russia be defeated in this situation, or is this just an illusion that some political leaders have in Brussels, in other Western European capitals?
If the question is whether Russia can be defeated by Ukrainians, I think it's unrealistic. But if the question is whether Russia can be defeated by NATO, that's another story. But then you have to be prepared for losing, yes, for hell, and for losing tens or hundreds of thousands of lives of people from NATO countries. And nobody's ready for that. Everybody would like to use Ukrainian people as the infantry, as a real flesh, but someone else might decide instead of them. But in that case, Russia cannot be defeated. If NATO joins Ukraine, that's a different story. But then the consequences are also very much different. Speaking about Russia's economy, yes, it's deteriorating, and no doubt, whether they face bigger problems, bigger issues, you will listen to Nabiullina. She confirms that. Everybody knows that. They don't even depict the situation in a better way than it is. But whether it's enough to beat them militarily, no, it's not. And don't forget what Donald Tusk was saying a month ago. Russia has one advantage. Those people know how to survive under difficult circumstances, and they're ready to fight. Are all the others in Europe ready to fight? Not sure. I don't believe in that.
Serbia is also a European country. You could say, at the crossroads of North and South.
Yeah, it has always been the case.
East and West, all the time. Always you've seen all the conflicts in your history of Europe. Can Europe survive economically without a partnership with Russia?
I hope that Europe will develop better partnership with Russia. But I believe in diligence, dedication, and rationality of European people. Why I'm saying that? Protestant ethic addicts, but also Catholic ethics from Austria, Bavaria, parts of Switzerland, France, Northern Italy, is a type of ethics that was bringing those countries thousands of times to a raison d'etre, which is asking them to act in a rational way. And I hope that Europe will come to that. Which means, okay, let us make peace, true ceasefire, whatever, as soon as possible. Then let us give diplomacy a chance. Then let us start thinking about something good, not always about punishing someone. Because punishing someone, it won't bring us to a compromising solutions. It won't bring us to any solutions. Then.
And being arrogant too. I mean, it's not the way to deal with others.
It didn't bring anything good to anyone. But let me say, China is a rising power, skyrocketing, militarily, economically, whatever part of social field you take, they're becoming either number one, either number two in the world. You have to cooperate with China. I am a big friend of China. I believe so, and I believe in them. I believe in their Iowa Tiger, which is seen nowhere else in the world. We cannot compete. I was visiting Uzbekistan. We cannot compete with them. We are different. We ask for more time for vacation, more bigger weekends, longer weekends, more city break destinations to be visited and everything. And no, they have an Iowa Tiger. They want to progress and to develop themselves much faster. Chinese are unbeatable in that.
Vietnam,
of course. Having in mind that, seeing the real changes in the world. Okay, let me see what we can do. Then you need Russia. You'll need Russia. You'll need their natural resources. You'll need their people. Not in order to fight China, but in order to create some real contenders to Chinese. Speaking about Americans and Europeans, to me, we are too small. I'll keep the very best relationship with Chinese, with Americans, with Russians, with everybody, to the extent that I can, which is very difficult, to be very honest. But at the same time, you want to go against China, you want to go against Russia, you want to go against everybody that you don't like because of alleged human rights or whatever else. It's insane. it's not the same world.
It's suicide.
It could have been your choice 30 years ago, but not today. The world is changing much faster than anybody expected, but they don't get it.
What makes you optimistic that Europe still has a future? I mean, one could argue Europe will terminally decline. We will just go down the drain. What makes you optimistic that there is still hope for Europe?
I believe that Europe will finally have a leader that will say, okay, we made some mistakes in the past. Now it's time to assess the issues in a professional and rational way and to find the best path forward to the future. And I believe in that. I really believe in that. Otherwise, we'll be very close to precipice, to the real abyss.
You are a political survivor too. You're now for 8 years president of a country. You're attacked occasionally.
Almost 9 years.
Yeah, you're attacked occasionally. Of course, you have also friends, but you're criticized. It's a very difficult situation. You have war. Russia is an old ally. You're balancing over the abyss. What is the most important thing you have learned as a politician in these last 3 years? What's the most important
thing? Three things. You have to stick to your ideas, to your beliefs, to your politics. And I do. Without ideas, without plans, without programs, you're nobody. Even when you are attacked from outside, from inside, from all those guys and states and people that would like to see different Serbia in terms not to be independent enough, but just to be another puppet state or whatever else. Of course, it's not easy. Then we come to, but you have to stick to your policy, to your ideas. Number two, you have to work as much as you can every single day. You have to live that life. You have to show determination, devotion, and have to work very hard. And you have to always be ready to respond to difficult challenges. And that's it. On the other hand, number three is you need to have a strong organization, you need to have people that are ready to fight for their country, for the path that country had chosen in elections. And these are three main preterms, preconditions in order to survive difficult times. What I survived in last almost 14 years, when I was deputy prime minister, then almost 9 years president, and very few people actually survived. But it was, and at the end, which is a cherry on a cake, it's your results, it's what you did, and it's what you do.
And
it's about what you have already delivered, and it's about expectations and what you are going to deliver in the future.
When one, as a young politician, you're still comparably young, as a president, long-term president, you're 55.
Yes.
I mean, one big problem of power is, as the famous saying goes, power corrupts. The longer you stay in power, you're surrounded by people who say yes all the time, who give you the filtered information. You get the routine of being in charge, of being in power. You're now in a situation where there are still tens of thousands of people in Serbia saying, President Vucic, he has been corrupted by power. He has let it happen that a clientele of strong confidants, allies, is running the country, and the symbol of all this is the collapse of this structure in Novi Sad. What is your answer to this, and how do you prevent being corrupted? Because every, even the most able politicians, it's very hard to keep that at bay.
I use self-criticism more often than you might even imagine. And I'm, let's say 2 years ago, I noticed at one moment that I was a bit tired and exhausted. It was migrant crisis, the most terrible floods, fiscal consolidating measures. I had to cut the pensions and public wages. Just for you to know, when I became the prime minister, the level of public debt to GDP ratio was 79%, today is 43%. It's better than, twice better than European average, because it's 86, 87 European average, it's 43 in Serbia. That's what we did. But I felt that I became a bit less workaholic. Then I started fostering and forcing myself to change myself. Speaking about personal corruption, I'm not corrupted at all. I have no bank accounts in Switzerland. I have no bank accounts anywhere in the world apart from Serbia regular account, which is accessible for our institutions and agencies each year. And I have no big savings, nothing. I have no villas and houses and apartments, not in Switzerland, not in Germany, not in England, not in the States, not in France, Italy, Russia, nowhere in the world. And people here, they know it. That's why they respect me. They have something against local leaders, some people in my surroundings, and I'm doing my best to clean it up, which is not always easy. But that's the easiest possible attack against someone. Because when you want to, when you create this kind of dehumanization campaign, criminalization campaign, and then denial of all the results, all three campaigns united against just one guy, because you know that he's a pillar of stability and he's a pillar of your political opponents, then it's easy. The easiest way is to say everybody's corrupted, because every single man in this country or woman will find someone in a healthcare center, in municipality, in city hall, or wherever, that asked for bribery, that didn't allow him to do something which was in accordance with the law or whatever. And then the common denominator for everybody is that's Vučić's fault, which is okay. I'm ready to accept that type of a burden, that kind of a burden. But at the end, if you see the polls, we are increasing our numbers, improving our numbers, and they're like plunging and going down.
Would you say, in dealing with these protests, have you made mistakes?
No doubt. I made many mistakes. You cannot pass through a period of 1 year without making many mistakes.
Which one?
But at the end, many of them. I'm not going to reveal it. I'm not going to disclose it easily. It's for me. I have to learn from my own mistakes, from the other people's mistakes, but from my own mistakes, those are very painful mistakes, and I had to learn it. Otherwise, what have been toppled down so far 10 times? But if I may say, the other side made more mistakes because they were not ready to admit their mistakes, which is a good position for me. I'll continue with scrutinizing and analyzing my own mistakes in order not to repeat it again. And I'm happy that the other side does not analyze its own mistakes. Maybe they didn't make it.
We always end our interviews with the silver lining, not with the gloomy tones. And as a leader, you are always you have to find the silver lining, you have to find the source of optimism. What is the most recent development or event that made you cheerful, that made you confidential, that we are entering in a brighter future than the darkness of the past or the relative darkness
of the past? I can tell you, speaking about my country, when I saw the last report of an IMF, which is very strange, I love their analysis. I have always liked their analysis. They're tough, they are not always needed, but it's good to read their reports carefully. What I noticed is their anticipation that Serbia will have the biggest growth rate in Europe till 2030. 2026 to 2030, it'll be 4.0 growth rate of Serbia. And this is something good for the country. This is what makes me optimistic. It means that we did something. We created a good foundation for the future. Speaking about international relationship, I believe that if Trump will keep his pressure on all the sides, that we within 6 months, and if he includes Chinese in that pressure on everybody on Ukrainian conflict, that we can hope to get some kind of true ceasefire or peace within 6 months to 1 year, which looks a long period of time ahead of us. But if you remember that almost 4 years are behind us, that this might last for next 4 years, this is good, just to be finished as soon as possible.
Do you still want to join the European Union?
Yes, we are on EU.
Is that still a strategic goal?
Yes, we are on our EU path, but I believe that democracy functions in Europe, that they can hear some different voices, some different opinions, as I'm ready always to hear their different opinions.
So that's my very last question. You had a visit, I think, of Ursula von der Leyen recently when the EU visit Serbia. I guess you get a lot of teaching and a lot of lecturing of what you're supposed to do. Now you have the chance to address a wish or a certain lesson to Brussels. What could the European Union learn from Serbia? What could the European Union, what could the people in Brussels learn from your experience?
I don't believe they can learn a lot from us. I cannot say that Ursula was lecturing me, she was not. There were some other people that were doing so. But what I can say, dear friend, some people, some bureaucrats, they need to understand that it's good if you listen to someone. I listen to them. I do put myself into their shoes. I do understand their position on Russia. But they should understand our position as well. They should just put themselves into our shoes. They cannot know, they cannot understand situation here in the region better than I do. I don't claim that I do understand situation in Brussels or in Berlin or in Paris better than they do. They don't have to get to the same conclusions as we do. But at least hear us, listen to us on these issues. Then you'll have a wider and a clearer picture. That's what I do when I speak to them. I really mean it, because at the end, I think that Europeans, if you ask me if I were them, I would have said so far, okay, bring me Western Balkans, bring Moldova, bring whoever else wants to join the European Union. Show strategic approach, think strategically. Because if you say to me that Bulgaria was in a better shape in 2007 when joined European Union than Serbia today, nobody would believe in that here. Nobody. Which is actually at the end even not true. They are not far away from us even today. But I'm telling something that no one can explain. But at that time, there were some leaders that understood strategic issues. This is what I think. It's time for Europe to act in a more strategic way, not tactical way, not to address and refer to social network and public audience. Can I tell you something? When I got that response, I was flabbergasted in a way. In Brussels, they said to me, you know, Alexander, we can't do this because if we go against Kurti, the army of his trolls, the army of his bots will attack us. So you have your policy, you drive your politics in accordance with social networks? And then some of them were saying, unfortunately, yes. Then I said to them, that's why I'm political veteran and why I was replacing, or it was not me that was replacing you, but I was witnessing the replacement of so many presidents and prime ministers all over Europe. Because you were actually flattering people on social networks. I care about people's opinion, but I don't care about whether some people covered or discovered or uncovered or whatever the social networks might say. Because I told you, number one rule, have my ideas, have my politics, which is state politics, confirmed by people's decision in election, which is our and mine plans and programs. Otherwise, I don't get you to tell you the truth. But that's how it goes. I wish Europe all the best. And I hope that we'll all be smart enough to avoid traps in the future. And that we'll be ready to speak to everybody in order to get tranquility and stability to Europe in next 50 years at least.
President Vucic, many thanks for this conversation.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.